Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Honda has been the world's largest motorcycle manufacturer since 1959, as well as the world's largest manufacturer of internal combustion engines measured by volume, producing more than 14 million internal combustion engines each year. The company was also the eighth largest automobile manufacturer in the world, behind Toyota, Volkswagen, Hyundai, General Motors, Ford, Nissan, and Fiat Chrysler automobiles in 2015. Welcome to our animated show of history. Today, we present to you Honda, A Brief History. Please stay updated with our animated history by subscribing to the channel. Honda was founded by Soichiro Honda in 1937. Throughout his life, Soichiro Honda had an interest in automobiles. He worked as a mechanic at the Art Shokai Garage, where he tuned cars and entered them in races. With financing from his friend, Kato Shichiro, Honda founded Tokai Seiki, or Eastern Sea Precision Machine Company, to make piston rings. After initial failures, Tokai Seiki won a contract to supply piston rings to Toyota, but lost the contract due to the poor quality of their products. Honda attended an engineering school but did not graduate. Thanks to the visits to factories around Japan to better understand Toyota's quality control processes, by 1941, Honda was able to mass-produce piston rings acceptable to Toyota, using an automated process that could employ even unskilled wartime laborers. Tokai Seiki was placed under control of the Ministry of Commerce and Industry at the start of World War II, and Soichiro Honda was demoted from president to senior managing director after Toyota took a 40% stake in the company. During the wartime, U.S. bomber attacks destroyed the Yamashita and Itawa plant. Soichiro Honda sold the salvageable remains of the company to Toyota after the war for 450,000 yen and used the proceeds to found the Honda Technical Research Institute. With a staff of 12 men working in a 16-square-meter shack, they built and sold improvised motorized bicycles. Using a supply of 500 two-stroke 50cc Tohatsu War Surplus Radio Generator engines, when the engines ran out, Honda began building their own copy of the Tohatsu engine and supplying these to customers to attach to their bicycles. This was the Honda A-Type, nicknamed the Bada Bada for the sound the engine made. In 1949, the Honda Technical Research Institute was liquidated for 1 million yen, or about $5,000 today. These funds were used to incorporate Honda Motor Company. At about the same time, Honda hired engineer Kihachiro Kawashima and Takeo Fujisawa, who provided indispensable business and marketing expertise to complement Soichiro Honda's technical bent. The close partnership between Honda and Fujisawa helped the company thrive. The first complete motorcycle, with both the frame and engine made by Honda, was the 1949 D-Type, the first Honda to go by the name Dream. Honda Motor Company grew in a short time to become the world's largest manufacturer of motorcycles by 1964. The first production automobile from Honda was a mini pickup truck powered by a small 356cc straight-four gasoline engine. During the 70s, Honda continued to develop new lines of vehicles and expand their horizons. Honda exported its cars, Honda Civic, to the United States. These highly fuel-efficient cars were exactly what the American public needed as the energy crisis hit full swing and gas prices soared. A new stage in the history of Honda was underway as they became the first Japanese automobile manufacturer to open a production facility in the U.S. in 1979. The Accord was built at the brand new Marysville, Ohio manufacturing facility. In 1984, Honda CRX HF was the first car in the world to reach an EPA rating of 50 miles per gallon. Over the next few decades, Honda worked to expand its product line and expanded operations and exports to numerous countries around the world. Honda introduced the successful Acura brand in an attempt to gain ground in the luxury vehicle market. After the death of its founder, Soichiro Honda, in the early 90s, the new CEO, Kawamoto, acted quickly to change Honda's corporate culture, rushing through market-driven product development that resulted in the first-generation Odyssey and the CR-V. The most shocking change to Honda came when Kawamoto ended the company's successful participation in Formula One after the 1992 season. Since then, Honda has become a household name. It became a leader in producing quality automobiles that consumers love to drive. They've even earned the 24th spot on Forbes' Most Valuable Brands list. The Honda Aircraft Company was established in 1995 as a wholly owned subsidiary. Its goal was to produce jet aircraft under Honda's name. As part of its vision to create a more sustainable mobility future, Honda introduced the Clarity Fuel Cell. Representing the leading edge of zero-emissions vehicle technology, the hydrogen-powered Clarity can travel up to 366 miles on a single tank of fuel, can be refueled in 3 to 5 minutes, and emits only water vapor. The 2018 Honda Accord, the 10th generation of America's most popular car, earned the prestigious North American Car of the Year Award. Accord was the first model from a Japanese automaker to be made in America, with production exceeding 11 million vehicles over more than 35 years. Honda is currently working toward a crucial goal, which is to lower CO2 emissions by 30%. It's all part of their mission to ensure blue skies for children, protecting the Earth for future generations. What did you learn from the history of Honda? Please tell us in the comments. Also, check out our other videos on history of other big corporations. Thanks for watching, and don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.
You are watching Cold Fusion TV.
Hi, welcome to another Cold Fusion video. Honda. For decades, this brand has been seen as a friendly face in the auto industry. With taglines like the power of dreams, there's always been a sense that Honda isn't just a money-making machine. There seems to be a curiosity behind their engineering. This fits exactly with the attitude of their namesake, Soichiro Honda, who founded the company. In this video, we're going to take a look at the story of Honda and how one small Japanese company became a household name. The story starts with Soichiro Honda, born in 1906 in the rural village of Konyo in Japan. Soichiro's father was a blacksmith, and the young boy spent much of his time helping him repair bicycles. From his experience in his father's workshop, Soichiro had an early love for engine mechanics. At age 15, without a formal education, Soichiro left his small village and headed to Tokyo in search of work. He soon found himself working as an apprentice in an auto garage. At just age 17, he would develop a race car that won trophies and set a new average speed record. It was clear that the boy had talent. In 1937, he decided to start his own company, mainly focusing on making piston rings. That same year, his company managed to receive a large order from a brand new car manufacturer named Toyota. Unfortunately, Soichiro would lose the contract due to the quality of his parts not being up to scratch. He chose not to give up though, and decided to attend engineering school, though without graduating, and take a close look and observation at factories around Japan. He spent 2 years painstakingly observing the best engineering practices. Once he did this, he understood the purpose of quality control, and by 1941, Honda was able to mass-produce piston rings acceptable to Toyota. The orders from Toyota was actually much larger than Honda could manage in his current workshop, so he wanted to build a new one. But a major issue stood in his way. Japan was gearing up for World War II, and this meant that a lot of materials were in short supply, particularly cement. So, Honda had to work out how to make his own cement before being able to build a new factory to meet Toyota's order. These new factories did survive the war, but Mother Nature, who was never one to miss out on a practical joke, destroyed the buildings in an earthquake. Honda decided to cut his losses and sold the whole business to Toyota, allowing him to focus on his first true love, the motorbike. So while materials had been scarce before the war, now that the fighting was over, Honda and the people of Japan were faced with a shortage of petrol. What people really needed was a way to get around easily while being extremely fuel efficient. Honda saw this gap in the market. His plan was to start installing surplus military engines onto traditional bicycles, creating a kind of hybrid. The first product put to the market was the A-type motorbike. By 1949, he had a fully designed frame and engine on a bike called the Model D, and the D stood for Dream. At this point, he joined forces with Takeo Fujisawa and created the Honda Company as we know it today. Fujisawa brought capital, but more than money, he brought business and financial insight. Honda's fascination with mechanics led to an incredible redesign of the four-stroke engine. With this new innovation, he managed to double the horsepower. This redesign helped Honda capture 15% of the Japanese motorcycle market within a few years. However, Soichiro didn't really care about that. For him, the breakthrough was that this engine could mean a lot for Honda's performance on the track, and soon, the racing achievements easily matched those of the business. By the end of the 1950s, they had won every important prize you can think of all around the globe. Soichiro probably would have driven the machines himself if it hadn't been for a racing accident back in 1936, which seriously injured his left eye. Soichiro would later describe how he worked so hard in his cars that he would go a week without sleep just to perfect their problems. He stated that he saw the car as his child and he as its mother. The push for success on the track led to many developments that could be put into future production machines. So naturally, you would think that Honda would build on this brand of a world-beating speed machine, but they did just the opposite. The company's main success was driven by the 1958 50cc Super Cub, which had been specifically designed to be a safe and simple runabout. They specifically wanted a product that included women and other individuals who otherwise wouldn't ride a motorcycle. This was to expand on the typical male customer base of the motorbike. The Super Cub bike needed to be easy enough to drive with just one hand so customers could carry their shopping or deliver a package. It was basically a bike for running errands, and it sold in huge numbers. Within just 2 years of its release, the Super Cub made Honda the biggest motorcycle manufacturer in Japan. And surprisingly, the Super Cub itself is still in production. Over 100 million have now been manufactured, making it the most produced motor vehicle in history. Honda, riding high on the Super Cub's popularity, thought it was time to look across the seas. They set up American Honda Company in 1959. Interestingly, Honda didn't rely on established distributors because they knew that they weren't going after the existing motorcycle market. They were going to create an entirely new one for people who previously thought motorcycles were dangerous. It was a complete reversal of the big macho image in the United States, thanks in part to celebrities like James Dean and Elvis. So to highlight this different approach by Honda, they sold their bikes in sporting goods stores, hobby shops, and even hardware stores instead of existing bike retailers. And their tagline really hit the point home. It was, "You meet the nicest people on a Honda." And it worked. Within a year, almost 50% of the bikes sold on American soil were from Honda. Maybe this shows the enduring power of advertising, but if we're honest, it probably has more to do with the fact that they were selling a lighter bike with double the horsepower at well under a quarter of the price of American-made machines. From 1960 to 1965, the revenue of Honda's American branch went from $500,000 to almost $80 million. During this period, the firm was producing 100 bikes per month, while other major bike manufacturers were only managing 15,000 a year. Honda were far and away the largest motorbike producer, and still are till this day. In 1967, the time had come for Honda to spread its wings. They were going to go from two wheels to four. Soichiro Honda himself was excited by the idea of building affordable, efficient cars. It was his lifelong dream. Honda studied small European cars, such as the ones developed by Fiat, in the late 1960s. The new class of ultra-compact cars seemed to be the right direction. Their first attempt was a two-door pickup truck, the Honda T360, but this vehicle didn't really gain much traction at home or abroad. But as fate would have it, the mood of the world was changing, and changing in Honda's favor. As a result of social change in the 1960s, the early 70s saw a growth of the environmental movement. There was now a growing dissatisfaction in regards to the air quality in major US cities. This spawned the Clean Air Act of 1970, where all manufacturers were to comply with new strict regulations on vehicle emissions. In a rather telling moment, the three largest auto manufacturers in the United States testified to Congress adamant that these new rules were impossible to achieve. To the shock of everyone, a representative from Honda said that it could be done. As a result, the Americans did take on the challenge, but it was done as more of an afterthought. They put something called a catalytic converter in their cars to clean up the air after it had been combusted in the engine. Honda, on the other hand, tried a different approach. They built a totally new, revolutionary engine from the ground up that passed the emissions tests right off the bat. This revolutionary engine was called a compound vortex controlled combustion engine, or CVCC for short. The very first car to use this engine would be a smash hit. It will be launched in 1973, and its name was the Honda Civic.
Some of the new cars tend to be choosy when it comes to fuel.
Unleaded, please!
Unleaded, first time I ever run out.
Diesel, just follow that truck!
Hondas are different. All Honda engines operate without a catalytic converter, so you can use either regular or unleaded gas.
Fill her up!
Yes!
Which one, ma'am?
You rush me, young man.
If you own a Honda, you can be the one who's choosy.
By this time, gas prices in the United States were high, and the Civic was light on fuel and reliable. It was the perfect car at the perfect time. Car buyers were spreading the word that this new little Japanese company called Honda built reliable cars, and soon they were selling 10,000 Civics per month. The sales continued, and in just over a decade, Honda established themselves as one of the world's leading car manufacturers. In the 1980s, the company set up a manufacturing branch in the US, and the Honda Accord was the first international car to be made in the United States in 1982. Interestingly, the quality of the cars were the same as their Japanese counterparts. This dispelled the age-old myth that American workers were inferior to the Japanese. This proved once and for all that the real problem was with American management and not the workers. As the 90s rolled around, the strength of the company continued, and the Japanese firm overtook Chrysler to become the third biggest car manufacturer in the United States. But by 1993, they began to slip as they were hit with a scandal when it was discovered that a number of Honda managers were accepting tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, from dealers who wanted special treatment and franchise options. After these issues, Honda returned to what it did best, engineering. Soichiro Honda may have died in 1991, but his enthusiasm for research and development was still very much a part of who Honda were. They led the major manufacturers when it came to emissions and regularly experimented with alternative fuels,
One such experiment was the Honda Dream, which won the largest ever solar-powered car race. As the new century began, their efforts to improve efficiency paid off as a sudden spike in oil prices meant that consumers suddenly valued this aspect far higher than ever before. Honda saw an increase in popularity in their gas-electric hybrids, and with the Civic GX in 2006, they were the first company to make a natural gas-powered car for the general public. Today, Honda's image is much the same as it's always been. They are still seen as a reliable, well-made brand who focus on efficiency and great research and development. Honda is the eighth largest auto manufacturer on the planet, but interestingly, they make the most internal combustion engines of any company, clocking in at 14 million units last year. Honda is on track to produce over 5 million vehicles this year. The company has factories in over 20 countries. Honda currently has about 208,000 employees. They made $130 billion in revenue in 2016 and just under $30 billion in profit. Just for comparison, the top two, Volkswagen and Toyota, both had revenues of $250 billion and $45 billion respectively. Although struggling in their local markets, as they have been for a while, Honda's future may in part be seen in partnerships like the one they have with General Motors, where they're working on creating a fuel cell to be released into the market in 2020. While cars make up 70% of their revenue, motorcycle sales in the emerging markets, especially India, reveal some mind-blowing numbers. They're selling 17 million motorcycles in India annually, compared to just 500,000 in the United States. The company also makes a wide range of motorized products, everything from outboard motors and boats to lawnmowers, hedge trimmers, water pumps, leaf blowers, and various types of generators, just to name a few. Honda has built 57 of their only aircraft, a jet called the HA420, which currently costs $4.5 million per unit. Probably one of their most well-known, but still interesting, side projects is the famous Astemo robot, which stands for Advanced Step in Innovative Mobility. The robot is part of Honda's research and development robotics program, which started back in 1986, but they've come a long way since then. And yes, although Astemo still may struggle with stairs, it's still an interesting project for Honda to have. Honda's newer robots include a multi-purpose utility robot, an emotional companion, and a robot that serves as the wheelchair reimagined. Honda believes that robots should understand human needs and improve lives. Alright, so we're almost at the end of the video, but before we wrap up, let's look at four interesting facts about Honda. Number 4. In the world of motorsports, Honda has the greatest number of victories in all disciplines. Using their racing engineer knowledge, Honda set to work on building a reliable mid-engine sports car. The result was the Honda NSX, released in 1990. It was a stunning car that went head-to-head with the likes of Ferrari and Porsche. The new NSX, released in 2016, has three electric motors and a 3.5-litre V6 turbo with a combined power output of 573 horsepower. This power is put through a 9-speed transmission that propels the car from 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in 2.9 seconds. Not bad for a Honda. Number 3. In 1981, the Honda Accord was the first car to have an onboard navigation system. It wasn't a GPS like we have today, but a series of manual maps with an onboard gyroscope to calculate the car's position. Number 2. The VTEC, or Variable Valve Timing and Lift Electric Control, is a system developed by Honda which results in high performance at high RPM and lower fuel consumption at low RPM. Number 1. Soichiro Honda didn't care for a traditional education, as highlighted by his mischief during school. You see, back then, his school gave grade reports to children to give over to their parents to view. As a confirmation that the parents had seen it, the form was to be stamped with a family seal. The tinkering Soichiro created a stamp to forge his family seal out of a used bicycle pedal cover. He even made stamps for other children, but ended up getting busted in doing so. Honda has been quoted as saying, "I don't give a damn about a diploma. What I want is the knowledge." He also has a couple of other good quotes. For example, the explanation of a Japanese proverb. It goes, "Raise the sail with your stronger hand." And this means, go after the opportunities in life that you are best equipped to do. He also said, "I'd sooner die than imitate people. That's why we work so hard, because we don't imitate." And another one, "Success is 99% failure." And I think this last one's pretty good. When I take stock of life, I realize how important personal contact is and how much more they are worth than innovation of machines, because people open up thousands of experiences which we would otherwise be unable to understand. So there you have it. That's a bit about the history, size, and some facts about the Honda Motor Company. For me, it's interesting to think that Soichiro Honda's ingenuity from a young age and passion for quality carried through with the company for the better part of a century. Even when some of the biggest auto manufacturers in the world said that the environmental regulations put upon them by the government was impossible, little Honda proved them all wrong through straight engineering. And I think that's pretty cool. But anyway, let me know what you guys think in the comment section below. If you've just stumbled across this channel, feel free to subscribe. This has been Dagogo, you've been watching Cold Fusion, and until next time, I'll catch you again soon for the next video. Cheers guys, have a good one.
To the top of the world, Soichiro Honda, a man of great dreams. Victory in the Isle of Man Tourist Trophy Race was his first step towards the achievement of his dreams. In 1959, 7 years after pledging his participation, a Honda machine made this first dream come true. And the dream expanded from two-wheel to four-wheel vehicles. In 1964, Honda challenged the world in Formula One racing. In 1984, Honda once again challenged Formula One. And finally, in 1986, Honda won the constructors' title over the other powerful international competitors. The dream which had long lived within Soichiro Honda had finally come true.
責任を負いですからね。だから責任を重いから我々がその自動車屋が非常にありがたいんです。
In 1906, Soichiro Honda was born in Tenryu City, Shizuoka Prefecture, as the eldest son in his family. His father was a blacksmith. Here is a story which illustrates Soichiro's natural interest in mechanics, which began in his childhood days. When Soichiro was in grade school, an automobile came for the first time to his village. Young Soichiro was hypnotized by the sound of its engine and the smell of its exhaust. Soichiro scooped the oil-saturated dirt into his hands, whiffed the scent of an advancing era, and soon dreamed his vision for the future. After graduating from secondary school, Soichiro decided to go to Tokyo alone. There he joined the art company, which was then one of the few auto repair shops in Japan. As he worked repairing cars, Soichiro began his task of building his own racing car, his childhood dream.
そうしますと、あっちんはあれ、こっちんはいつ、いろいろ、もう、そうね、一週間も寝ずに仕事をして、で、やっと完成した自分の子供みたいなもんで走るんですからね。なんて言っていいかね。それは、母親に例えてもいいんじゃないかね。
Okay, today's podcast is titled Nelson, actually Laura Nelson, Shakiro Honda, the founder of Honda, and Factory City equals, and I got a dollar sign.
In August 1945, the war ended. Soichiro withdrew from the piston ring business and planned his next business. Shortly after, Soichiro came up with a revolutionary idea. He would build the small engines used by the Japanese Imperial Army for communication purposes onto bicycles. The result was an incredibly popular and successful product. In 1946, the Honda Technical Research Institute was established, marking a true beginning for his dream. The A-type engine was developed and its production was started. A bicycle with an A-type engine was introduced and became an overnight success. In September 1948, Honda Motor Company was established, the first step toward a global Honda. It was at this factory that the prototype of today's motorcycle was completed and named the Dream.
で、そういう心に置いておいて、うちの若い人たちに、なし話して名前はドリームとつけるのどうだなった。それはいいだろうと。夢があることはいいことだと。で、そんじゃ、それにしようと。で、ドリームと名をつけて、来て、やってます。それから40年ですね。40年。ねえ。でっかい夢を今掴んだという感じがしますけれども。
Okay, we've got some, this audio is still going, but it's got some blank spots. Anyway, today we're talking about Laura Nelson, the 11-year-old, well, she's 12 years old now.
12-year-old Laura Nelson. どうにも、うち自体が行かない。で、藤沢がうちへ来てくださって、じゃあ俺が金取るというような話。それっきりの話で約束もなければ何にもない、縁もゆかりもない二人でございます。私には兄弟もございます。がしかし、兄弟より以上に他人というものは大事だということ。 この年になって初めてとつくづく思うわけでございます。私がたまたま本田宗一郎という誰も、私が1000人の友達を選べと言われたら、1番が本田宗一郎であることは、これは今もちろんでございます。で、2番手と1番と2番とがどうも間が空きすぎてて2番が出てこない。 やっぱりこれは本田宗一郎。そういうふうにしていきますと、1000人が1000人の名前出した時に本田宗一郎というのが私の中にもしいたかったらば、偉そうな顔してここへ上がることはできませんし、また多少さっき褒められましたけれど、私のしたことで、あるいは本田一軒が
今日になったとすれば大変な世の中の巡り合いの素晴らしさって言いますか、感謝する運の良さ、私の幸せをつくづく感じて、今日。
Okay, this audio's got some hiccups in it. Anyway, you know what? Let me stop it. Today's podcast is titled Laura Nelson. Well, it's, yeah, let me get it from this breath. Nelson plus Honda plus Factory City. The Nelson stands for Laura Nelson, who's now 12 years old. When she was 11 years old, she bought a camper for like $400, fixed it up for $400, total $800 fixed up. And I want to use that as a prototype of what we shall be doing offline. The second person we played some audio today about Honda, Shakiro Honda, who the founder of Honda Motors, Honda, everything you might think of. He started off his business in a shack, manufacturing parts of bicycles, bicycle motors, and then Factory City, which is a community of people who manufacture coffee pots, lamps, there's a whole bunch of products. But the focal point is this. Take somebody like Laura Nelson, who's 12 years old right now, and if she does that, and let's say she gets something, fixes it up, and then sells it and makes a $5,000 profit. Okay, and let's say she sold it for maybe $6,000 or something like that, makes a $5,000 profit. But if she does that 100,000 times, she'll be a billionaire, or anybody can. So people like Honda's done it, Toyota's done it, there are other people who've done it. So I'm just trying to broaden your horizon, your thinking today. In any event, here's more about Laura Nelson.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home,
and she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning,
but that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months, and with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Hygge. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800. She has three envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the Tiny Home Nation. She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same, which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing.
If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components. not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. Huss' supplier is only a bike ride away.
3000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
因为现在市场已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的，一点钟准时安排送料。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply, and soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha. And the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news.
小叶，小六。
晚才来。
没办法，这边已经那个模具刚刚才修好。抱歉。
数量多少？
虽然有2000个。
He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers.
Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of UPAP and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done,
Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Lee runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced.
In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Szechuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job? Address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands, and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yuba's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yuba's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yuba has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yuba's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yuba must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yuba's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances, and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yuba's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yuba's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype.